Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2Manage Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of The Bend. Today, I have a very interesting guest. We had never met before, but I found her through a post on LinkedIn and went, I've got to talk to her. So Jana Dewey is with us today. She is originally from Jupiter, Florida, moved to Colorado 6 years ago to work as a zookeeper at the Denver Zoo. She has a BA in psychology and a minor in theater from a Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers. She has a master's in counseling. She is an LPCC. She is certified equine assisted mental health practitioner and a certified professional bird trainer. She's worked in the zoo field for about 10 years. She started off performing in Pet Shenanigans, which is a show at Busch Gardens in Williamsburg. And I've been to that show. It's been quite a while. She's trained rescue dogs, cats, birds, pigs, and rats. After that, she was a showkeeper at the Naples Zoo, where she gained a strong foundation in positive reinforcement training, which I am a firm believer in. Works with exotics like servals, macaws, birds of prey, ocelots, and a Komodo dragon. She, in addition to working in the zoo field, she has experience managing training wheels in Bloomfield, and it's a boarding and training facility that specializes in dogs with behavior sensitivities. And she was able to manage dogs who had anxiety, fear, bite histories, and other types of sensitivities. She also has extensive experience with horses, and she helps a Mustang rescue called Mustang Whiskey Ranch. In her spare time, which I can't believe she has any, she's outside exploring Colorado with her two rescue dogs. And she loves to learn, enjoy curling up with a good book on human or animal behavior. She is also a fear-free certified training professional. So Jana, man, we are speaking the same language when it comes to behavior and people and animals. We probably have a library that's shared. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to chat with you on, human and animal behavior.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about how you started in your profession, because, it wasn't strictly into veterinary medicine. It was like, there's so much zoo stuff there. That's very cool.
Yeah. So I actually, I grew up in a very rural town, so grew up around horses. And so that's kind of how I got my in with animals. I always knew I wanted to work with animals in some way. When I was really young, I really wanted to be a veterinarian, and I volunteered for the local vet, and I saw a dog's nail get quicked and saw just all this blood, and I almost passed out. So I knew vet med was not for me. But I was always drawn to behavior without even knowing it. And so from a young age, I loved training. And, they talk about these moments that kind of shape who we are. And so I grew up in Florida. I grew up, for those who can't see me, I have a whale poster behind me because I love whales. I love marine mammals. And so I grew up going to SeaWorld. And so I remember there was this moment, I was probably in early middle school. I actually didn't go. We didn't get to go that year to see the new orca show. So I watched it on YouTube. And I remember just seeing the trainer and the whale, and I started bawling. And I had no idea why. I just thought it was the most beautiful thing. And ever since then, I was like, well, I'm going to be a trainer. I really want to be a marine mammal trainer, which is what made me go into working with exotic. And I got my theater background because I knew I wanted to do shows. I had horrible stage fright, so I forced myself to do theater to get over that. And so, I just ended up, my first trainer job was in Busch Gardens as, that show trainer role, which was amazing. And then, from there, I just kept falling into show roles, and I absolutely loved it. The marine mammal route never worked out for me, but it kind of worked out for the better. And so, I ended up sticking with shows and training. I every facility I worked at, I ended up working with the more sensitive animals. So the ones that other people had a hard time with, or there are a few animals who, they're kind of not given up on, but it was like their last chance of we need to have a job for them, help them feel comfortable. And if not, this might not be the role for them. And so as I kept moving around to different zoos, I realized how much I love behavior, and I saw some of the challenges the humans in the field had. So that's what drew me to wanting to go into therapy work. Especially when I started managing at training wheels with behaviorally sensitive dogs, I got story after story how hard it was living with sensitive animals, which was a different side of the animal care field I did not think about till then. And so at that time, I was in school already, but it just kind of put a fire under me and just made me want to keep pushing forward so I could help people. So, long story short, I love behavior. I love helping animals and humans, and it all just kind of came together.
That's an incredible story. And I always love to see the path of like how you got from there to here. A couple of things that I wanted to ask about, because there's two things that really struck me. First of all, how did you learn to get over stage fright? Because I think that a lot of times when we have people who work in veterinary medicine, they gravitate to it because they're not all about people. You know, they like the animals better. And a lot of times I think they're not as relaxed around humans as they are around the animals. So how were you trained to get over stage fright?
Forced myself to go to theater productions. I started off in high school. In high school, I was really big into band. So I actually got offered scholarships to go to college for playing flute. I was like, first year, I was really good at it. It wasn't my path. I didn't want to be a musician for my life. But every time I got up on stage, I've been playing flute since I was in elementary school. I always got awful stage fright. I wouldn't play. So I knew the moment I knew I want to be a marine mammal trainer. I saw I needed to do shows and productions and be able to speak in front of huge audiences. I needed to really learn how to do that. And so, starting in high school, I joined theater. I forced myself to audition. I got roles. And same thing in college, because I was still, it was high school, I was still having a lot of anxiety. And I was very driven. I'm very goal oriented. I'm a very passionate person. So I was like, if I want to do this, I'm doing it all the way. Made myself get my minor in theater and just auditioned for everything I could that I had the time for, and just kind of just, put myself out there and practiced honing my emotions while I was performing.
I love that the goal, you always kept that goal in mind and then forced yourself to get over this challenge that you had. Because it's funny, if people have met me know that I'm at this point in my life, I'm kind of a social butterfly. But when I was young, I was really shy. And then one day I had this epiphany that everybody was as nervous as I was about, new things and meeting new people. And so I might as well just power through it because they were in the same boat. And then after that, I never looked back. I kind of said, okay, they're just they're feeling the same thing I'm feeling. So if I'm going to make them comfortable, then we'll both feel more comfortable, and that's just how I'll do it. But so that's really, really interesting. And then I think the thing that I always think about those shows at Busch Gardens is not to sit on the first row because you're going to get drowned on the first row. Obviously, your original plan didn't work out and there was a curveball. How did you choose to kind of go with the flow or veer off that? Because you said I'm very goal oriented and your goal was that. How did you veer off that path and feel good about that?
At first, it was really hard, honestly. And to be frank, I didn't feel good about it for a long time. It was something I'd worked so hard for, and I even got like scuba certified, and it took the SeaWorld test. Like I prepped for it, which is it's very strenuous and really hard, and I worked months to be able to do it. Interned at SeaWorld as well, so I did everything I could that was in my power. What wasn't in my power was my resources at the time. And, part of being in the field is it is a bit privileged in some areas more than others. And so what it came down to is I wasn't able to afford that life. And that was the reality of it. And it sucked. You know, I worked really hard and, you know, I built this career and I had always wanted to work with marine mammals and I found myself going somewhere else. And I'd always talk to my friends and things about it too. So I got that social support. And so when I was feeling down, I talked to them how down I was and how I still was a marine mammal trainer. Especially when I worked at the zoo in Florida, I was like, I am here, I'm in Florida, I'm a trainer, it's not working. And again, I didn't have the resources to travel at a moment's notice to go take a swim test. And even in the animal field, you know, you don't get paid a lot, especially marine mammal trainers. A lot of zookeepers don't, especially starting off, and I just didn't have the resources at that time. And that was something I had to come to terms with. And it sucked. I had to really like take a step back and figure out, well, what else could I do?
Right.
Like, I loved working with animals. That was never a question. But like, what do I do now that my goal shifts? Especially for people out there who are like me, who get really hyper focused on one thing and then it doesn't happen. Super shattering. Ugh, I was so depressed. I just shifted what I could have my goals be, which was to be a really good trainer and be the best trainer I can be. So that's kind of how I shifted. But again, for a while, it really sucked. And I just had to, you know, talk to my friends and get support and look at what the career I was making rather than think about the career I didn't get.
Yeah. You know, that's so funny that you say that, because like you, I was a kid who wanted to be a veterinarian and I wanted to be an equine vet because I was a horse girl growing up. And the practicalities and realities of it, after you start to get into it and you're really, do I really want to do this? I don't know if I do or not. And then when life kind of throws you that curveball and I end up managing, I really found my niche. I found my sweet spot that I was in the medicine. I was around the animals, but I really liked the people part of it too. So managing things and being creative in marketing and all the fun of management. I know a lot of people think that's not fun, but for me, I loved it. And my staff used to say, I wouldn't have your job for anything. I went, I love my job. Why wouldn't you want my job? It's the best job on earth. So it really is sometimes just life does throw you a curveball, but you have to look at it as another opportunity opens up. And maybe that's where you were meant to be all along. So what has been your, you know, other than that, like your toughest life challenge? I mean, obviously, that was a letdown, but now, you know, or, you know, how scary was that for you? Like, I've had this goal since day one, and now what?
It's really scary. And I didn't really know what to do. I felt really lost. Again, I was really good at training and doing shows, but I didn't want to just do something because I was good at it. So I did a lot of reflection. And again, I think that kind of drove me into you doing what I do now. Because I kept looking how I can be better and better, right? Like, what does being the best trainer mean? I didn't know. That was just my new goal. And so I just kept feeling myself getting burned out at all these facilities because I kept reaching for more and more. And so I took a step back when I was at Denver. And I was like, I keep moving to all these places. I keep trying to find that job that is just going to be my lightning bolt. And at first it always is, and then it wears down. And so I really took a step back and asked myself, why do I want to be a trainer? Why am I still in this field? I couldn't bring myself to think about doing anything other than working with animals. And so I slowed down and just really reflected. And it really got me thinking, well, I love training and I wanted to work with marine mammals because I wanted to train the most intelligent animals out there. And so it got me thinking, I was like, well, humans are intelligent. And at the time, very naive, I assumed that counseling was like training. I was like, well, I could train humans. And, you know, I've always been a really empathetic person. And I wanted to go into shows so I could inspire people and help people understand the animal's struggles and the animal's point of view. And also to connect. That's really my big thing, is I really enjoy making connections with animals. That's why I love training. Because that's what it comes down to. I'm teaching how can we communicate with each other. And I love doing that with people. And so that's what kind of took me back. And I was like, well, therapist is going to be, I think, a good job for me. Because I could bring everything in. And to keep my animals as well, I got my equine assisted mental health practitioner certificate. So I could do equine therapy. And yeah, and that's kind of how I got started on that and how it all came together in a weird way.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes it's just, it's like things fall into place when they're supposed to. But I love the fact that you said people are intelligent, and they are. But sometimes we have doubts, right? Because sometimes people don't act intelligently. When I started to get my fear-free certification, and I had been talking about customer service and behavior and culture for so many years, and I said, oh, this is all the same stuff that I teach about humans. It is really, and so when we understand fear-free behavior and those limbic brain responses, we really are better at client service, because we can take what we know from animal behavior and just translate it right on into the human, because the limbic brain's system works exactly the same in people as it does in animals. And fear is fear. And many times fear is false, but our brain is not really allowing us to think with the smart part in those first reactions. You know, you, in looking at your bio, I just keep thinking this woman has the patience of Job, because I think that's one of the challenges with training and even understanding humans is patience. It requires so much patience. And for certain personality styles, they don't have any patience. They want it done yesterday. But to tell me a little bit about, and this is not on our script, but now I'm fascinated by this. Like, when you're working with these really difficult animals, where do you start? I mean, what is the most, I guess, low key, low stress point that you start with to try to get an animal to relax?
Yeah, the very first point is really that they can around me, or at least take food I throw to them. That is kind of the first step. Like, the first animal I really trained who was really sensitive, who he was the one who I was like, well, I love training them more than anything. It was my first zookeeper job in Naples, and they walked me up to this enclosure. I was getting a tour of all the animals in our department. And they walked me up to this enclosure, and in the corner was a little red fox, and he was hunkered down. He was like curled up. His eyes were big, super scared. And he was the one a lot of people had trouble working with, because he was just so scared. He was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being like, well, I would want to work with him, right? That's like my first day on the job, first day as a new zookeeper. And I'm like, I want to work with one of the most difficult animals in this department. And my boss at the time is a very good friend of mine. She was like, all right, I'm going to give you a few months and see what you can do with him. And she's like, we'll talk about training, but she's like, he's your project. And granted, this was a show role. So having a super fearful little fox go from that to a show role was a big challenge. And all I did was I would walk by, toss him food, and walk away. And I worked with him for about probably the first 2 months. I had like six sessions a day with him. Whether that's all I would do, I'd walk by, toss food, walk away. And once he wasn't running at the sight of me, right, I was just counter conditioning me approaching and being around people, he would start like looking for me, and he would take food readily rather than wait for me to walk away and like grab it really quick. So once he could do that, I would start sitting with him and just toss food to him, toss food, and then walk away. And just build up a relationship of, this is what I do with the animals now that are really fearful. I just build up a relationship of, when I approach, here's food, and then I walk away. And it's always by the animal's choice, right? Because I can't force an animal to feel something different. I'm helping with counter conditioning of changing that emotional response, but I can't make it go faster or slower. Super frustrating, but you have to go the animal's pace. And the more you give them the choice and the autonomy, the more they're going to opt in. You're also letting them opt out when they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so even with all my animals, I teach them like a shut off cue or a turn off cue of like, all right, this is how we walk away, or this is what it means if you want to pause in the session. But that's really the first step, is I want them to know when I approach, good things happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Doing a lot of counter conditioning.
I love that. Now you have all these certifications in human counseling. So if we have difficult people, or people who are always coming into our hospital stress and stressing us out, what is the first thing that we should do with the human treats? What's a human treat?
I think giving space and letting people make choices. And it is the hardest thing, especially if you're in the animal field going into therapy work or trying to. A lot of people, and I had this same mindset, is humans are the same as working with animals. And like you're saying, there's similarities, right? Like there's science behind, like fear responses are similar and our fight or flight, but it's so different. And when I was learning theories, I was like, I'm going to be behaviorist. Or go after behaviorism, which is like positive reinforcement and doing that with people. My professor was like, all right, we're going to touch on behaviorism, but no one really does this much anymore. Because it just doesn't hit all the levels you need to with people, because we can make up things that aren't even here, right? I can have a fear response in my house and nothing's even happening. Or I could be having a trauma response and a little noise triggered it. Things like that. So what I do with folks who, and I have had some clients who, I mean, they are resistant. I just give them space. And it's like, all right, we can sit here. That's fine. It's your choice. And thinking about too on your side of like what can you control and what you can't control. Right? Like I can't control how people respond to me. I can't control what they do. It is their choice. What I can do is do my part in helping them, so providing information. And again, this is my theoretical orientation in counseling, is I really do not provide, I don't provide answers a lot of times, right? I want people to get there on their own. They already know what they need. It's just how can I help guide them in that right direction? And so, yeah, I've had sessions where I'll just sit and be like, all right, we'll just hang out and like you let me know what you need when you need it and I'm here. So yeah, when I have a difficult person in my, because I still train, I do that, right? I'm there to help their animals, so I focus on that. But I can't force the people, like they don't do the homework we talked about.
Right.
Like, all right, that was on you, right? I'm not gonna force that on you. Same thing if they don't provide the care you think they should with their animals, that's their animal and that's their choice, right?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of some of the burnout in veterinary medicine is their frustration with the fact that people don't do what we coach them to do. But you can only do what you can do. You can only control yourself, and you can't control what people do at home. You can teach, you can encourage, you can remind, but it's still on to that person to, to do what they need to do for the pet. And we laugh and think about people treats. In our hospital, we actually kept candy and we had people treats. And it became so automatic for people to walk in the door and walk to the candy jar that they immediately started to get a good experience from the beginning. And the things that you can do that are similar to positive reinforcement is recognize people's names and have a conversation that makes a connection with them and know who their pet is and know who their kids are and where they're in college. And those are all little positive reinforcement things that say, this is a safe place to be, and these people care, and they won't harm me. But I have one of my favorite slides in my slide deck is talking about conflict resolution. And I put up this picture of an angry man, and I put up this picture of an angry dog, and they're side by side. And I said, look at the body language, because the body language is so similar. The teeth are bared, the hackles are up, the eyes are hard. And I went, would you go pet this dog? And they go, oh no. And I went, why would you go talk to the man? You got to let him have space, right? Just what you said, you got to let him come down to an emotional level where you can have a conversation, because otherwise you're just going to ramp him up. If you approach that dog and try to pet it, he's going to feel backed into the corner. And the same thing is going to happen to that human. So you just got to let people have their space. And for me, I think people treats are words. They can go, I understand, tell me more, I'm listening. So this is what you said. And so people start to feel like you're listening to them rather than they have to battle to be heard, because that's the other thing that's going on too, is like you want to make your point, they want to make their point, and nobody's listening to the other one because we haven't gotten to that space yet. So this is always a fun question for me. What do you consider to be your biggest career mistake?
I would say probably it was the fact that I felt was advocating for myself and leaving situations that didn't work for me anymore. But what happened is I just kept moving on and on faster and faster. And faster being, I mean, I'd be somewhere for a few years and then get burnt out. But I felt it happening quicker and quicker. And again, it led me to that awareness of, man, why is this happening? So it ended up bringing a lot of self-awareness. But again, I had to recognize it instead of blaming the institutions and think about, well, okay, what can I control to stop getting in this cycle versus, well, I'm just going to stay here and fight the man and be mad. that's not, yeah, exactly. Because I just know so many people that do that. And some people don't have choices, right? I was lucky enough to be able to have the opportunity to go get my master's. It was a lot of work, but I was able to do it. But yeah, that was probably my biggest mistake. And I also had to learn along the way about conflict resolution. That was not something I had learned. So I also told people I went to get my master's to learn how to be a better person. And it was more so, it was for me just as much as how I can help other people.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I love
there are definitely bumps.
What you just said there was, instead of using good conflict resolution skills, I would just kind of ditch it, right, and move on to the next place, thinking it was going to be the unicorn. And I love that you're saying that, because I'm seeing so many people going, I'm getting out of vet med, it's so toxic, blah, blah, blah. I'm going over into human healthcare. Well, it's toxic too. Every job has the potential for toxicity, depending on the workplace. And you can't keep jumping jobs, hoping to find nirvana if you don't have conflict resolution skills so that you can go in and actually implement change in that practice, or implement change where you are, or at least speak up and say, here's the problem. Because as a manager, I managed for 23 years. And before that, my family owned restaurants. And so I was like the boss's kid. And I was always in a position of authority from this, from youth. But so many times people will stew about something that's going on, and then they won't come and tell the manager that it's happening. I remember a very particular story that we had a summer assistant working in the kennel, and we had a big boarding kennel, and we did playtime sessions, and we would charge clients a fee, and we would have these dogs taken out like for extra exercise and personal one-on-one playtime, frisbees and swimming pool, whole nine yards. Well, she was so upset because we didn't realize that people were asking for it so much and willing to pay for it so much that there were not enough hours in the day to do all the sessions. And so she just said, you just keep taking money from these people and it's impossible. I went, well, why didn't you tell us before now, before it got to be impossible, so that we could cut it off and we could make a plan and strategize to say, no, we can only do so many on the weekends, or we don't do them on Sunday or whatever. And so there was this automatic assumption that we didn't care, that we were just trying to drive the revenue in, rather than we didn't know that there was that many happening, that so that we need to stop and control it. And so I think it's being willing to go to the people who are in authority and say, hey, this is a problem. And I don't know that you know about it, but we need to fix it. And here's how I think we can fix it. Rather than you don't care. And I'm assuming that, right? I'm assuming you don't care, because I did care and we fixed it. So I love that you brought that up, because I think it's an incredibly important point. Try to fix it before you jump ship. Just don't, if you don't tell it somebody, how do they know? I used to tell clients the same thing when they complained. And, we would go through and I would listen to them, and they would then apologize for complaining. I would never do that, because if you don't tell me, I don't know. If I don't know, I can't fix it. So thank you very much for complaining. And then they would go, really? I would, yeah, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Same thing for the staff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And hey, I think depending on how the feedback is received, perpetuates that culture, right? Like, I was really big into, like, I see a problem, I'm going to talk about it. What I didn't have all the time was my own communication skills. So sometimes it came off rough, or maybe more complaining than I wanted it to. But I think the other part of this too is having good self-awareness and reminding yourself of why it's worth it for you. Because there might be times it's not. You're like, this job is not worth it for me. I've done everything in my power and control.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
It is time to leave. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but there's some, like, again, I had to take that step back and be like, why do I keep wanting a zoo job? Like, why am I sticking in this field? And that really helped ground me of like, all right, I could deal with a lot of frustrations because I know this is what I want to do. Things like that.
You mentioned something about self-awareness, and I heard an excellent speaker at the Veterinary Innovation Summit, and she talked about self-awareness, and it's the study, she's been studying it for like 25 years, and you probably are familiar with her, and I think her name is no, I can't even say it, and I don't want to because that'll be wrong, but she talked about how most people are not self-aware, and they do not understand that their behavior is off-putting to other people. And it's so funny that the stat that stuck in my head was, how many of you think that other people cannot drive? And so everybody raised their hand, like people are terrible drivers. How many of you think you are a good driver? Well, everybody raises their hand. So obviously there's some bad drivers in this group, but they all raise their hand thinking they're good drivers. So we're not particularly self-aware until we have knowledge that lets us step back from ourselves and look at it and go, oh, that probably wasn't a smart move on my part to do whatever I just did because it didn't work out well. Hopefully we learn from failure. I think that when we're young and dumb, we do stuff. And I remember telling a story about when I was a brand new manager, and this lady came in and she was complaining about paying a $20 exam fee for this dog that was in for allergies. And I had gone and explained why we needed to do it, and on and on and on, done all my customer service skills, and she was still fussing. And finally, I just looked at her and I had it. And I handed $20 back to her over the counter and made a copy of her one-page record. And I said, "Lady, I won't kill your dog for $20. And if you want to, you need to go somewhere else." And I slid across the counter.
Oh
So
my gosh.
I said, "I wouldn't do that today, right?"
Right.
I would, but we learn, emotional intelligence, and we learn what works and what doesn't work. And the older you get, hopefully, the more you learn that, as they always say, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. You got to learn to bite your tongue and learn these skills. Now, you said something about a friend of yours was in charge of an area of the zoo. Did you network your way through these zoo jobs from place to place? Is that how you made these? Because I know I interview veterinarians, and so many of them want to go into zoo medicine. There's like four jobs in the universe for that. So, and those people aren't leaving them. So did the networking, when you found that valuable to get you where you are?
So I started off working at the zoo. It's called Naples Zoo. Really awesome zoo in South Florida. But when I went to school for my undergraduate, again, I was very driven and I was like, I'm gonna get a job at the zoo so I can start talking to zookeepers and get my name out there. So I started off working there my sophomore year of college, worked all throughout the rest of college. And I started off in the gift shop. And so I was able, it was, again, a small zoo, so there were zookeepers. We saw each other. So I would just stop them and, like, ask them what it took for them to get there and start knowing them. I grew into like a tour guide position. We had like a boat tour. So, and I did sailing in college. So I got to like drive boats and do tours. And so I got to learn more from the zookeeper since I was more directly interacting with the animals. But yeah, I literally, at the time, I was probably really annoying, but I didn't care. But literally, every zookeeper I saw, I would stop them and be like, hey, my name's Janet. Can you tell me what it's like to be a zookeeper? How did you get here? And again, small zoo. So when I left and I was interning at SeaWorld, I was like already looking at jobs to line up after SeaWorld. And so I saw the Busch Gardens position. And I got it luckily because I was willing to move to Virginia pretty quick. And so that was just circumstantial. And I had animal training background and horse training, and with doing the boats and the theater background, it fit really well. And then, yeah, there was a position that opened up in Naples for the show department because I knew everyone in the show department already. I networked with them. I became friends with them. They knew me. The manager at the time did not know me. Again, she's one of my best friends now, but she was actually really hesitant to hire me at first because it was a team of all men. And through my interview, I was a little more timid. And so she didn't think I might, she was afraid I might not be able to hold my own or mesh very well with the team. So luckily she took a chance and she hired me on, and it was awesome. But yeah, I couldn't have done without networking. And again, at Denver Zoo, when I went there, everyone knows each other. And again, it was a show position. It's a small community. So word of mouth goes a long way. Again, whenever I got into conflict, I might not have always been great at it, but I always tried to make amends and do what I could on my part to not burn bridges, and get along with everyone. And sorry, I'm laughing because there are a few folks I did have some trouble with. And a phrase that really helped me when I was in conflict or if I had to have a meeting with people and I wasn't excited about it is every conversation I'm going to learn something. It might be learning something I don't want to do, but I'm going to learn something. And so that really helped. But yeah, through networking and having as much of a positive attitude as I could and really showing my talent and growing myself professionally as well and learning, it went a long way.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now because you work at a behavior practice in Colorado, and there are multiple doctors there and staff members who are all focused on behavior, but you're also on that staff to help the humans that come in. So tell us a little bit about that. You have such a unique job now.
The stars really aligned with this job because when I was in school, I got into it because I really wanted to work with people in the animal care field. But as I progressed more and more, I was just kept thinking, how am I going to make this work starting right off? This isn't a thing. Everyone I told in my classes, my professors, and my supervisors, and I was like, this is what I want to do. I'm actually an animal trainer. I was a zookeeper. They're like, well, that's different. Not in a bad way. It's just there were no other folks there with the same background. Yeah, I was at Denver Zoo and I saw this job. And again, I love working with behaviorally sensitive animals. I took this job as I was finishing up my schooling and I just offered it. So I was like, hey, so I'm going to be graduating. And I feel like these skills could really help a lot of the folks I work with or we work with. Because working with, again, I got this at Training Wheels, but especially here at Behavior Vets, we are sometimes the last resort for a lot of people. And we work with a lot of bite cases and severe behavior cases, and some do end up in behavioral euthanasia, and that's the best choice for some of these animals. So it's really, really emotional. And I can't tell you how many sessions I've gone into, and the folks are just already crying because they're burned out of training. They don't know what to do. They feel lost. And of course, I'm not in a therapist role in that moment. So I can't sit down with them and say, let's explore what's going on for you. I'll give them the space to tell me their experience, but I'm not there to process. I'm there to support them in regards to their animals training. I feel really lucky that I can help the animal side as well as those folks who are having a really hard time living with a sensitive animal or maybe coping with a euthanasia or even a bite. Bites are really traumatic for a lot of people, and there's a lot of science behind the physicality of trauma. And so I'm really lucky and excited that I can now help those folks and help them process emotions so they can have a more positive experience with their animal and with their lives, because it does take such a huge toll. And I'm really glad this is finally a field that's coming.
Yeah, it is. The University of Tennessee has their veterinary social work, and I've talked to several people who are social workers or have their degrees in social work who are focusing in the veterinary space. And I see a lot of big, especially hospitals, particularly hiring social workers because, especially veterinary emergency, when you have big major cases, a lot of trauma involved. I can remember, even as a child, we were going to church one Sunday and our puppy bit the tire of the car and my mother rolled over his head
Oh
and
my gosh.
it was horrible. And of course
Yeah.
immediately called my father, but the dog died like, almost instantly.
Yeah.
But those are traumatic events for people to process. And I'm so glad that we have people who are, kind of understand both sides of the coin, because if you're not a pet owner, it's very difficult to understand the bond that people have with their animals. And one of the things that you said about caregiving for a behavior problem animal is it is exhausting. People feel guilty that they can't do it right, but sometimes these animals are there. It's not possible. They're not possible to be fixed. And people need to have some coaching that says there was nothing, you know, like sometimes people, the brain is just wired wrong and it just is. And we see it a lot with some genetic stuff that happens with animal breeding that is not accounted for. I remember having a Great Dane client, a dog that had sudden rage syndrome. And when you have something that weighs 120 pounds turn on you for no reason, and they went to the behaviorist at NC State, they did everything they could to take care of that dog. And one day it bit someone. And that was, you know, that was like the final straw. They said, we give up. But they loved the dog. They really did.
Yeah. But
eventually, you know, you just have to come to the reality that it's something that you can't handle. And the animal is miserable and the people are miserable, and animals are here because we enjoy them. They are to enhance our lives and we're to enhance theirs. And when that's not possible in either direction, then euthanasia is absolutely an option. And they might have a hard time coming to grips with it, but you know it, I know it, behavior vets know it, all veterinarians know it, that sometimes there's things that you just can't do anything about.
And it's just those cases, like you said, like the cases I've seen, it was always the right choice for that family, but it might be hard for them to share that experience, especially for wonderful therapists who might not know anything about animals, but might still feel a little weird sharing that experience, or maybe it feels shameful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might feel a little more comfortable to share that with someone who has experience in both fields and has been there.
Yeah.
And same thing with like the vet side and the trainer side. Like I know when I've had cases I've worked with, when it ends up in euthanasia, I get affected. And so we can experience that sadness as well. And so it's processing in numerous ways and a whole system's involved in that.
Well, just think about even having to, have someone go, well, where is your dog? And then you have to say, well, we put it to sleep because it had these behavior issues and we couldn't trust it around people or around other animals or, something like that. And then there's, is there judgment there that they're dealing with? Well, those people walk away, well, that was my dog. It would have never done that. And sometimes I see that in veterinary teams, that it's the owner's fault that these animals are the way they are. I will tell you, I've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of animals in my career. And some of them are just nothing works. And even no matter what you try, drugs, whatever, they just cannot be trusted and they become dangerous. And so that's, and they're miserable. That's the other thing that I think people need to realize is that the animals are miserable because they don't want to be hurt either. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I share with folks when we have sensitive animals, I always compare it to horse training. Yeah, I'm a horse person, so that's where my brain goes. But when we train horses, horses are scared of really what we would consider silly things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they see a plastic bag and they're like, our world is ending. to us, right? As humans, we're like, this is a little tiny bag. Like you're being ridiculous. So that horse, it is life or death.
Mm-hmm.
And so for these dogs who are really experiencing anxiety and fear, it's real for them.
Mm-hmm.
We might be like, you see us every day, same thing, and they're still scared of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, that's an animal's experience, and we have to go at their pace, and it's really hard. And I think along with euthanasia, this goes along with rehoming too. Like I have a lot of rehoming, not a lot of rehoming cases, but I do have a few. And again, it's really hard, but it's always the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of shame around rehoming. And so I think it also makes people hesitant to even talk about that kind of loss.
Yes.
Because it is. It's a loss for everyone.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that told many of my friends, when they're trying to pick an animal, especially a dog, they're like, go and talk to your veterinarian because the breed makes all the difference. And it's got to match your family and it's got to match the age of your children. And it's got to match your lifestyle and, your environment so that the animal is not miserable and the animal doesn't make you miserable, because the point is to have something that you enjoy coming into your house. I just got a new dog and I searched for 2.5 years to find a dog. And that's because I know a lot. And so I looked at rescue. Because that was my first goal, was to find a rescue. And all I saw was, I looked and I saw allergies. I saw skin issues.
Yep.
I saw behavior problems. And I thought, or otherwise they were ancient. And I don't want a dog that's that old. I wanted a younger dog. So I ended up finding a dog that was 15 months old or 14 months old when I got him. And he's been a great fit. You know, he's been work because he was not house trained and there was all kinds of stuff to
Yeah.
utilize. But you know, we've only had him like 12 weeks and he's learned a lot. So it's, but he, I know that because of the kind of dog he is and from his background and I, you know, his socialization, I talked to his handler, I talked to his breeder, I talked to friends of his breeder. I asked his breeder so many questions that she thought I was insane. And I said, but these are the kind of coaching questions I would give to a client to ask about this dog. And I also know that he's had health certifications and that 3 generations back, his siblings and parents were healthy. So if you know, I don't think animals are not an impulse buy, and that's how they end up a lot of times. And that's how we get into some behavior issues because we pick the wrong pet for us and how we
Oh
live.
my gosh.
Yeah.
That resonates big time. I actually, the dog who got me really started on the path of working with sensitive dogs was an impulse buy. I will totally admit it. She was super cute and she was tired, and I thought she was the chillest dog I've ever seen. And she was a little pitty mixed. And I brought her home, and I at the time had like an 80-pound shepherd mix. And as soon as I put them together, she wanted to murder him.
Oh, wow.
Little baby puppy, and I was like, well, that was my fault. And yeah, and it wasn't like a initial, like she was worried. She was very dog reactive, and so I am totally with you there of like doing research, slow it down. And again, I think it goes back to that self-awareness of your family and your lifestyle. And it's okay to say, you know, as nice as it would be to say, let's all rescue elderly senior dogs or dogs that have behavior issues or skin allergies. It's not realistic for everyone, and it's okay to say it's not doable for us, or we just don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't want to. And you know, I am busy. I travel, and I wanted a dog that was going to be fun, that I could take with me, and that would be well socialized. And so when I found out that Tucker had grown up he was a show dog in a house, and he lived in the house with his handler who had 3 small kids and 8 dogs in the house, I thought, yep, this is a well-socialized dog. And he is fearless. He doesn't fear the vacuum cleaner. He doesn't fear people, other dog. He's a happy dog. And I know that this is his socialization growing up. So, you know, it's important to research and important to ask people who know before you go and buy a problem. So, Jana, tell us what advice you would give someone who is facing a big career decision or a life decision? How would you help them work through the process?
Yeah, I would say that's a really good question. I would say slow it down and really think about your values and your priorities in life and what drives you. And that's what's going to help move you through to the next stage or what you want. Because if you're just, again, if you're just doing something because you're good at it, that might be your calling. It might not. Some people are really good at a lot of things that they might not really enjoy. So think about what's important for you as an individual, not thinking about anyone else but your experience, and go from there. And again, think of like, you know, why are you in the job now? What made you choose this? What don't you like? What do you like? And you can talk through, I mean, social support's super important, especially when you're going through crisis or a hard time. So talk it through trusted family, friends and peers, colleagues, family, people you trust and you can be really open about. That's what helps me. I talk to my other friends in the animal field. And so I just talking through it and doing my own work and sitting down, as corny as it sounds, sitting down with myself and really thinking about my experiences and what did I want. You know, some of these jobs too, if you think of a career, think about, okay, is this actually realistic for me? Like, right? I would love to be like, I don't actually want to be, but some people are like, I'm going to be an actress. All right, so to do that, you need to have the finances to maybe not have a job for a little bit. You have to have the time to go to auditions at a moment's notice. You have to move to certain places. And it's like, if that's not doable, that is okay. That's just the reality. Might suck to, right? That was kind of my experience. It sucked. That was my reality, but that's what it was.
Right. That's
And
exactly
so I
right.
figured out, Yeah, so I could figure out what else would be just as fulfilling as that other path that worked for me. And sometimes you might have to make sacrifices, like getting my master's. I have not had a free weekend in so long. I'm finally graduated, so I have time, but I sacrifice a lot of time. You know, it's expensive getting my master's and I have loans, things like that. But that's worth it for me. It might not be worth it for other people. So being very realistic about what you want and what drives you.
So tell us a fun fact about you. Do you have a secret talent? Do you have a favorite song? Something people might be surprised to learn. You already told us that you play the flute.
Play the flute. I haven't played it in a long time. Let's see. I used to compete in sailing tournaments in
Oh, wow.
college. I haven't in a, obviously since college, but and we weren't a very good team. We did it for the fun of it, not the competition, at least most of us. But I would say that's probably pretty fun. I'm learning archery right now because I have time and I've always wanted to learn archery.
Oh,
So.
you know, that was always my favorite sport in PE. I loved archery and gymnastics.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah, except when you hit your if you don't pay attention, if you don't do it right, you hit your forearm, and that hurts. That hurts a lot.
Yeah, I had a really gnarly bruise after my first
Yes,
session.
you've got to cock that wrist, or you're gonna get nailed. Any
Yep.
final words of wisdom? Anything that, you know, like a favorite book that you would recommend, a favorite quote that motivates you, or even a shout out to a person who has helped you along the way?
Oh, I can think of something in all those. One of my favorite books, I actually have it here. It's a really simple book. It's a kid's book. I think they just made a movie or short film out of it, but it's The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's just really pretty. And again, one of my, I strive to be kind to anyone, to everyone. That is one of my virtues. Like, I want to be known as kind. I don't want to be a pushover. I want to be kind. But
Yes.
that's kind of what this is about, and learning lessons about kindness and, you know, being who you are authentically. And so, really simple. It's just, and it's really beautiful. And again, I love foxes and horses. And so, I just love it. And then there's a really great book. It's called Dark Night of the Soul. It's very dramatic sounding. It is a wonderful book for anyone maybe experiencing a difficult time. And it is, it's all about kind of going into where we might be scared to go, like depression. But out of that comes really beautiful things and more awareness and knowledge of the world. As far as being human, there's a really big stigma around experiencing anxiety or depression. And so this book is all about that of like, nope, let yourself feel it. Obviously, don't, if you're feeling unsafe, you know, there are resources out there. Or if you feel like you can't control your depression, but really great book. One of my big motivators to go into my master's program was a woman named Susan Friedman, Dr. Susan Friedman. Her website's BehaviorWorks, if anyone's interested in learning about her. She has a really cool course on animal behavior, but she actually started off as a human psychologist and really helped develop what it meant for animals to have choice. She's really well known in the zoo field. She's getting more well known in the domestic field as well. But she was my inspiration because every time she says something, just the way she words it is very heartfelt and empathetic. And so she was like, she was one of my motivators. I was like, I want to be like Dr. Susan Friedman.
Awesome. That's awesome. Well, now I'm going to have to go look her up and look up her website.
Oh,
All right.
she's awesome. So yeah, she's someone I really look up to. But yeah, I would say those are some good ones. The last word of wisdom, if you have something that inspires you or something that moves you, keep something around like that to help you to remember. Like I bought a whale necklace in college. It was actually right, actually it was after college. It was after my first zookeeper job. And I was coping with the fact I wasn't going to be a marine mammal trainer. So I have a whale fin I wear on me every single day to remind me of where I'm at. And it really helps me.
Yeah,
So
I
that's
love that.
helpful for anyone else out there.
Yeah, I love that. That's funny that you say this necklace that I have on was a gift from someone who was my lead technician for many years. And I always think about Babette, and you know what she her husband was in the military, so they moved overseas, and wonder, you know, like what she's doing now and how, because she was just an awesome person. And then I have another couple of things that, you know, my staff gave me as gifts as a manager. And I know that people probably don't think that, you would keep these things, but I haven't managed a hospital since 2008. And these were gifts from people back in like 25 and 30 years ago. So, and they still mean something to me because it confirmed for me that I was looking after my people like I was, that like I wanted to, and they appreciated it. So, I always say, give your managers some love. It's sometimes we just kind of think of them as like the hit man or whatever, but they're humans too. And they appreciate the small gestures, just like, they give gestures out. So receiving one every now and then is pretty nice too.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, Jana, thank you so much. And I really look forward to carrying on another and many other conversations with you, because the combination that you have with the animal training and behavior and the human training is just amazing. And I do hope that you are out on the speaker circuit and going to give some classes to people and enlighten veterinary medicine about how to handle the humans in their world. Because once you get the humans down pat, the animals are easy.
It's so true. It really is. That's the key.
That's it. All right. Thank you. And thank you everyone to joining us today on this episode of The Bend. We will have Jana's contact information in the show notes along with her bio. And I look forward to seeing her in the future and listening to her story as it plays out in veterinary medicine, because I suspect big things are coming. Thank you all very much for this joining us on The Bend. My name is Debbie Boone, and I am your host.